Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. My guest today is Julian Abel, MD. He is the Director of Compassionate Communities UK. Julian was on the show a couple of years ago to discuss his innovative model for combating social isolation in the town of Frome in Somerset, UK. The goal of his project was to improve health outcomes and quality of life, and a measurable difference was made in both healthcare cost savings and reduced emergency room admissions. The work of Compassionate Communities has since spurred further initiatives and is now transforming perspectives on matters of healthcare and social well-being around the world. On this podcast, Julie and I talk about the power of compassion and how reason, emotion, and inspiration can help build connection and reduce loneliness. Julian shares how Compassionate Communities is growing as a social movement and talks about what each of us can do to make the world a kinder place. He also reveals plans for Compassionate Communities USA, set to launch in the next few months with a free and inclusive conference. And just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from leg cramps to liver enzymes. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Julian Abel. Well, Julian, thank you so much for joining me this evening. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Chris. And it's such a pleasure to be here again. And we can see each other, which is always really nice. So I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's, yeah, absolute pleasure. I think it's been 4 years since you were last on the podcast. Can you believe that?
Goodness me.
It's crazy. Yeah. How's this era of lockdown been treating you in the UK? It's a strange time when you, of all people, know the importance of social connection, and yet that connection confers a risk of infectious disease. How have you been reconciling that?
So it's an interesting one. I think it's been really tough for many, many people. And I think we've been really imaginative in the different ways that we can connect with each other. Although, you know, you can't give somebody a physical hug over Zoom, there's lots that you can connect with. And on a personal level, we live down in Cornwall in the middle of nowhere. And so we've had space and the sea around us. And for about 6 months, we had all three of our children, our grown-up children here. And it was just such a privilege and so nice to have them there. And they've gone back, which is, you know, nice to have the space again. But we've been creative about doing things like, one of the things we started to do was with the kids is that we have a quiz night. So everyone comes with five questions and we all prepare food. And then we have a call. So we're all eating in our separate households, but we're relating. So on a personal level, we've been really, really lucky. And, you know, the space to exercise and in the elements and all of that. But I think for many people, particularly people stuck in cities, it's been really, really tough. As well, I think it's, you know, we have to remember that in the UK, you know, we've had one of the highest death rates per head of population in the whole world. And we've seen 20% extra deaths this year. And everyone who died, it's in difficult circumstances, irrespective of cause of death. It's not just COVID deaths. And people haven't been able to attend the people they love as they're dying. And they may have been carted off to hospital and they never see them again. And then they can't even go to the funeral. And I think it's been really, for many people, it's been really tough. But personally, we're doing well. Thank you. How about
you?
That's
great.
How's it been in the US?
We're in a similar situation, you know, where we're living by the ocean. I've always been working from home, or at least for the last 6 or 7 years. And so again, you know, like we've just been super lucky that we were set up the way that we were before all this kicked off. But Yeah, I would like to come and visit you in Cornwall. Can I come and visit you in Cornwall? I have a lot of very fond childhood memories of holidays in Cornwall.
I'd be devastated if you didn't. So you should definitely come and see us.
My wife will be delighted. That's fantastic. Thank you. Well, let's start at the beginning. I think in the last episode you recorded with Tommy, I think Tommy did a really great job, actually. I listened to that interview again yesterday. So I would encourage people to go back to listen to that one again. But can we start by you making the case for compassion? And I might request, at the risk of sounding a bit like a psychopath, that you define the word compassion, because I'm not sure that it always means the same thing when people use that word.
So it's interesting one about definitions, because human emotions and human experience isn't confined to definition. And the words are really symbols for something that go on inside ourselves. And so we tend to use words interchangeably, and people get a little bit hot under the collar about defining the difference between pity, empathy, and compassion. And I guess that on a very simple level, a way of looking at it is that we know personally what it is to suffer. Everyone suffers. There isn't anyone who escapes suffering. And so we recognize that, and we recognize that other people suffer. And through that, we know that people don't like it, and nobody likes to suffer. And so compassion is the recognition of suffering in other people, but it's not limited to that, because it becomes an imperative to act. So compassion in that sense is the care, the kindness, and the love that we have for other people, the recognition of their suffering, and the impelling us to act to try and relieve that suffering. And in a way, you can recognize it through emotion rather than through reasoning and logic or definition. It's a physical experience. It's something that's contained in our bones.
And I think you argue that this might be part of our evolutionary life history. Would you agree?
That opens a door to a polemic, and you're now going to have to shut me up.
Okay. You're the best type of interview, you know, like where I could just like sit back and like just press record. I'm just here to press record.
That's it from now onwards. If you look at the evidence of compassion in the human body, you find it everywhere. There isn't a place where it isn't expressed. And so you can look in physiology, you can look in biochemistry, you can look at social behavior, you can look at psychology. It's just everywhere. So, for example, one of the hallmarks of being able to measure something to do with this is the hormone oxytocin, and because it's the so-called socializing hormone. And then you go, okay, well, that's interesting. We see it in humans. Do we see it anywhere else? And the answer is you find it throughout the animal kingdom. It's unbelievable. Oxytocin and oxytocin receptors are present everywhere. And people say it's mostly in animals with backbones. But if you want to see an incredible example of compassion, go and see a film called My Octopus Teacher.
It's great. Oh, I've seen it.
Yeah. The moment where the octopus hugs the man that he's made friends with over his heart. It's so touching. And so what we're looking at is that the fact that it's present in all animals, and even plants respond to oxytocin, by the way, and the fact that human beings are the most social of animals means that it has a really significant evolutionary pressure. And in fact, the term survival of the fittest is some kind of nonsense British imperialistic term invented by a philosopher called Herbert Spencer just at the time of Charles Darwin. And it really doesn't express or represent about how we survived. And the evolutionary pressure of survival of the kindest is really significant. And there's a couple of, we produced our book, The Compassion Project, about the same time as a couple of other books. One, Brian Hare and Vanessa Woods, who you interviewed on Survival of the Friendliness, and another book called Humankind by Rutger Bregman, which talks about, rather than Homo sapiens, it's Homo puppy, kind of like that expression. And actually how if you get human beings together, we actually are good towards each other. And I think that when you develop the understanding that this is deeply embedded in who we are as human beings, then in terms of the health benefits, you can see that it far outweighs nearly every other intervention we have, in, much more than giving up drinking or smoking or exercising or diet, or even the one that makes me laugh the most is the drug treatment of high blood pressure, because the impact of social relationships, the heart of which is compassion, far outweighs the impact of drug treatment of high blood pressure, both in terms of death and in terms of well-being. So It's deeply ingrained as who we are, and we recognize it. You know, in those moments in our life where it might be, you know, kissing the person we love, holding our children's hand, having a nice conversation with someone that we never met down the shops. All of these things are little explosions, or sometimes big explosions, of oxytocin. And even witnessing that releases oxytocin in us ourselves and gives us a sense of feeling good. So not only do you have that embedded in who you are, we're programmed to respond to that just by witnessing it. And you have this kind of ripple effect where if you have a good moment, which is an expression of kindness and compassion, it spreads to the people around you. So it's ingrained in everything, and it's the most important evolutionary pressure we have.
Well, last time you were on the podcast, you talked about the fantastic results, published results, that you have from Frome. Am I pronouncing that right? I want to say Frome. It's not Frome, isn't it?
Perfectionist, yeah. Frome, in some
sense. Oh, it is Frome. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And we can link to your published paper, but can you explain then what it means for a community to be compassionate?
So you can think about this in terms of, on a personal level, where would you like to live? Would you like to live in a place where you kind of walk out on the street and you know that people are looking out for you, that you know you can go into a shop and chat and you know your neighbors by name, not just someone to say hello to, and rather than the English thing of not looking over the garden fence, you actually look over the garden fence and offer your neighbor a cup of tea and have a nice chat. And you can think that if you're in trouble, that you've got people you can turn to. There are people who are going to help out, and people who are not going to judge you. You know, not people are going to say, well, actually, you're a horrible person and I'm having nothing to do with you. It's like, oh my God, I'm sorry to hear about that. And what can I do to help? And so that you can think about, what do you live in that kind of an environment? Is that happening? Is it a place where children go outside and they feel safe and there are people are looking out for them? If you go down the hairdressers, do you have a nice chat with the hairdresser? If you go into a cafe, is a cafe owner listening out to you? If you go into the library, you know, and in a way you could say, well, look, that's, if it's like that, that's a normal human community. That's what it should be like. And that's a compassionate community. And if your community isn't like that, then there are these practice methods, these ways of using community development to turn your community into that kind of community. And in a way, we've invented these practice methods because we know it's so important, and that you can have lots of different ways of developing these kinds of communities. And we know that this happens the world over. And I'll tell you a story about this as well. I started a podcast called Survival of the Kindest. And one of the people that I had on the podcast was First Nations palliative care researcher called Holly Prince. Now, Holly came to a conference we held in Bristol in 2015, and she lived in First Nations communities in Canada. That was where she first came across the term compassionate communities. And she listened about, you know, how we're trying to develop these supportive communities where people can share and look out for each other. And Holly said two things. The first thing she said was, we already do that in First Nations communities. And the amazing thing is that in spite of the brutalization that has happened to First Nation communities, they have something which we desperately miss, that we can find this in many Indigenous and Aboriginal communities, which is this sense of connectedness and belonging. And as Mary Lou Kelly said, it's about interdependence, not independence. And the other thing she talked about was kinship and all my relations. And in the First Nations setting, this doesn't just mean our family members, but kinship is the people around us, the people in our community, and the animals, and the ground on which we walk, and the plants in which we eat, the food that we eat, and the air that we breathe, and that the water we drink, and that we have that sense of responsibility, if you like, that these are all our relations. We are accountable to all of that. We own that. We're part of it. We're deeply connected to it. And we may not think we are, but I think we found in the pandemic that actually we are deeply connected in all sorts of different ways.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring that up. You know, I saw that here in Bonnie Doon in Santa Cruz County last summer when the fire broke out and some crazy people decided they were going to stay and defend their homes. And the stories that emerged later of the compassion and social connection were really quite extraordinary. And my observation, is it the adversity that brings these people together? And sadly, it seems to disappear. Like once the trouble is gone, people go back to their everyday lives where they're more disconnected. But would you think that that's a common pattern?
It is a common pattern. And this kind of brings us on to something else that we've got planned. We started a charity called Compassionate Communities UK. And there's a load of stuff going on now. And you're definitely part of this, Chris, is about, you know, realizing the importance of social connectedness. And so one of the things we're doing in North America is we're having a summit series called Elevate Compassion, that we say that there's a, if we are going to support each other and get out of the terrible place that so much of the world is in, we're going to need to elevate compassion as a primary value. That this isn't just something that we need in times of trouble, we need it all the time. And so what we're looking at is drawing together the whole wide variety of different organizations and different people in North America who are already undertaking this work, not necessarily related to healthcare, but just about, you know, that in particular, you know, dealing with issues of racism, separation, isolation, loneliness. There's so much going on. You know, you can look at organizations such as Weave or the Aspen Institute or Asset-Based Community Development or the whole wide variety of different initiatives that are looking at social integration and dealing with what is a very divided society. And we want to bring them all together and say, we need to form a strong group. We need to have a sense of advocacy about these problems so that there is some kind of counterbalance to the really destructive forces that we're seeing around us in our society, you know, the degradation of the environment, loss of biodiversity, in greenhouse gases, increasing climate crisis and all of these things. Actually, there needs to be something which is a counterbalance to that. And we need not to lose the opportunity we have now. I think the scientific literature is increasingly becoming aware of the importance of compassion. And for example, Julianne Holt-Lundstedt, who wrote the paper on social relationships and mortality, has presented to the Senate on the importance of social relationships. And likewise, the American Academy of Sciences commissioned a document, which she was a co-author, which is a 200-page document about the importance of social relationships, that it's a public health initiative, which is at least as important as diet, exercise, giving up smoking, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a question about what do we choose now? What do we choose as individuals? And what do we choose as communities? And what do we choose in terms of educational institutions? What do we choose in businesses? And in particular, what do we choose in politics? Do we want the politics of division, hatred, and cheating people in whatever way we can to gain more ourselves? Or do we want the politics of compassion where we care for each other? And I certainly know what kind of a world I would prefer to live in.
How do you think that we got to where we are today then, if this compassion is embedded within our biology? How do we get to the point today where I feel like the society has become so atomized?
I think atomized is the right word. And there are lots of historical roots in it. And you can look historically at, there's this book called Sapiens, you know, about how ruling elites have dominated societies. And then Rutger Bregman talks about the contrast between Hobbes and Rousseau, about how Locke thought humans were inherently evil and Rousseau thought human beings were inherently good. And that's about the interpretation of what's called the social contract. Or you can look at, there's a really interesting thing about this guy called Edward, what's his name? Behrens. But now I can't never, always escapes me that thing. He was a nephew of Freud, and he wrote a book called Propaganda. And this was in 1928. And in this book, he said that it is not enough for people to want to buy stuff. We have to stimulate them to buy stuff that they don't need. And what you see is that from that point onwards, that propaganda describes marketing and sales, the same techniques which are used today. And that's really about leading us down the route of thinking that wealth is to do with money and its possession and power and status symbols. But actually, real wealth comes from relationships. It's the poor people are often richer in relationships than the rich people. And then you can say, well, okay, if you look at how we're in a really difficult situation now, because if people are driven by the greed for acquisition, then they lose their humanity often in the process of climbing up the ladder. And so what you see is that, if you like, as people get into greater positions of authority, they lose their humanity. And now what we're faced with is we see that this sense of wanting more, this sense of wanting more wealth, more power, more status, that we see it everywhere. We see it in politics in a really destructive way, using base emotions to increase a sense of power. We see it in businesses, that businesses have lost their morality. You know, the pharmaceutical industry is supposed to be for the good of human beings. I'm a doctor, and so I'm well used to the actions of the pharmaceutical industry. And for example, every pharmaceutical company in the US has been fined hundreds of millions of dollars for criminal activity. The opioid crisis in the US is largely driven by the pharmaceutical industry. The way that that industry works is powerfully negative, and it's all based around sales without respect for human life. And we see it in our educational institutions, so that objectivity has been lost to careers, and so that we see that people want to make a name for themselves and will cheat their results so that they can get the right papers and get the right kudos. And in particular, we see it in our media, who often have no respect for human frailty and are prepared to do anything so that they can push forward the stories which may have bear no relationship to truth whatsoever. And this is why, you know, we think that elevating compassion as a moral value is really important, that when you look at all of those areas, that you can see it as an abject failure of compassion. I interviewed just the nicest man called Waleed Nassif, who grew up in Iraq as an interpreter. And Waleed obviously ended up, he lived through the disaster that was Iraq and had to leave and ended up in Canada. And he remembers going to a meeting where Madeleine Albright was speaking. And somebody asked her the question. They said, look, somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqi children died as a consequence of not just the war, but the sanctions. And the question they said, was it worthwhile? And Madeleine Albright thought for a moment and said, yes, it was. And this was after the disaster of what happened as a consequence of the Iraq war, which in many ways was worse than what Saddam was doing. So I think that what you're saying, you know, how did we get into this? I would say it's been an abject failure of compassion that has been going on for a long time. And if we are to do anything about it, it's a personal responsibility to be more compassionate for everyone, to find ways back.
Well, my next question was, how do you do compassion at scale? What does it mean to be a compassionate country, for example? But I think you've maybe just answered that question already, right? It's at the political level.
So my friend and colleague, Alan Keller here, developed something called the Compassionate City Charter, which is a series of actions that can take place across our whole society. And the actions are in our educational institutions about how our education institutions can be more compassionate. They are how our media and our museums and galleries can stimulate this care for others, how our public spaces can be used for compassion, how we can develop compassionate communities. And I think that there's individual actions that we can take, but there are also municipal and civic actions which need to take place in all of these different settings, which they are, if you like, public health practice methods, which are evidence-based and which can be transformative. And it's about the creation of compassionate communities everywhere. I think it's vital. And I would say that, you know, the challenge is how do we get people to be more compassionate, even small steps of saying hello to your neighbor or asking somebody how they are. And I would say that there are three ways of thinking about this. One is reasoning and logic. And the reasoning and logic is actually overwhelming. If you look for it, it's there. So you interviewed James Maskell, and who wrote the book, The Community Cure, about the impact of how community, the impact of what happens when communities work together. And when you look at the kind of reasoning and logic aspect of it, the evidence is overwhelming, not the least of which is the evidence that comes from Froome, being able to reduce emergency population emergency admissions, which has never been done before. If there were a tablet that could do that, it would be a medical miracle, the size of which we've not seen before. The second way is about emotion, that we like to think of ourselves as being reasoning human beings. And although we are, a really significant bit of us is about emotion. And when we can think about our lives where the love and compassion is expressed in one way or another, and come to the conclusion that that was a good feeling and you gave something, you cared, not because you wanted something in return, but just out the goodness of your heart. And you go, I know what it is to be human in that moment and I want more of it. And then the third reason is about inspiration. It's about seeing a very public display of compassion or even a private one, or reading about it in a book or seeing it in a film or reading some poetry or being in nature and feeling inspired and saying, this inspires me to be more compassionate. And so I think it's about, we can change, but we've got three ways of changing and we need to use all of them and figure out which ones are more important for us than others.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Is altruism really altruistic, or is it that, you know, when we help someone, sure, you have no expectation of return from the recipient of your help, but you do have an expectation of feeling good, right?
That's it.
And that's the carrot, but maybe there's a stick there too. You know, the flip side is, well, if I see an opportunity to help someone and I walk on by, then I have to live with myself for the rest of the day, right? And so there's a carrot and a stick.
The thing about that is it makes sense. It connects us to something. It's not something, when you start to get sensitive to that, and you appreciate that, then it's a richness of life. And you know what right and wrong is. You don't need anyone to tell you. You don't have to read it in a book anywhere to say, yeah, this is the right way of doing things. This is about how you can lead your life and recognizing what it is, the benefits of being compassionate. That's where the richness comes from, a personal decision.
So back to the grassroots level, what does someone like me do as a practical concern, right? So maybe I'm working as a health coach. Maybe I just have a keen interest in health. Maybe I'm interested in helping other people with their health. So how do I go about this as a practical concern?
Well, I think the first stage is to recognize that you're already compassionate. And that might be sitting down and thinking about it. And it might be, what are the compassionate things I do? And on a very simple level, you know, loving your children, feeding your children, giving somebody a cup of tea, being nice to somebody down the shops, just looking out for your neighbors and giving your friend a call because you know they're isolated. And then you can look at what you've done, Chris, and you've used your own experience of health to stimulate the interest in helping others. And you've been tireless in trying to improve that in so many different ways. And that's a huge compassionate act, that you're doing it because you want to help others. And you can think about, if you work in an office, about how you treat your office colleagues. So the first step is to recognize that you're already compassionate. The stuff of life, we swim in a sea of compassion. It's going on all the time. The next step is to make the decision to be just a little bit more compassionate. A small step. Think about in your life a moment that you can easily apply this, where you might have had your head down and be grumpy, where you have every moment we have the opportunity to be compassionate and start in really small ways. So ring a friend who is in trouble. Say, I'm sorry to hear about the hardship you're going through. Or help somebody do something. Even opening a door for somebody is a compassionate act. It's contained within there. And then thinking about, okay, I want to be more compassionate, and use the three ways of being motivated to be more compassionate: the reasoning, the emotion, and the inspiration. And then when you start that process, then what happens is it's addictive, that you can't stop because you feel good about it. And it might inspire you to do more compassionate acts, to be more creative in your community, to volunteer to do things, to make sure that you try and find a better balance. I would say contained within there is this business about how you perceive wealth, because wealth that is based on power and money might sound good, but it's empty and dry. You can be the most powerful man in the world and the most lonely man in the world. My background is palliative care. So I have talked to thousands of people as they were dying, and I never once heard somebody say, I wish I'd spent more time at work. And the people who really impressed me the most were the people who reached the end of their lives and said, I've had a good life. I've had good family and good friends. I've really appreciated it. And so there's something about actually seeing that wealth is in community, is in our hearts, is in our relationships, and that we can share. Often the people who are the most generous are the poorest people in the world. They have nothing, but whatever they have, they will share it. And there's a real richness in that. So I think that it's about figuring it out for yourself and looking at your life, appreciating your strengths as a human being, appreciating that you carry with you this treasure of compassion that you are already using, that will bring you happiness and health, and then seeing how you can slowly increase it in your everyday life, step by step. I mean, I know that your podcast is very much health related. And for the listeners, I would say this: if you want to be really healthy, think about your relationships. We tend to break health down into thinking that health is the right diet, the right exercise, the right movement, the right relationships. But if you take the different components of what makes us healthy, it's not the individual component itself, it's the relationships that embed around it. And each one, you know, when you start to have an effect in one area, you have an effect in another area. And I'll give you an example. So if you think about people have poor diet and, you know, suffer from obesity and ill health that comes from that, and we think that the solution there is by improve your diet. But actually, there's a different way of looking at it, which is improve your relationships. Because if you're thinking about preparing food, okay, you've got to decide what to eat. You've got to go to the shops. You then got to cook the food and you've got to clear up. And it sounds like a drag, but you can turn it into joy. And the joy is go shopping with a friend, choose a recipe together, invite them round for a meal, cook together. When you sit down, put all your mobile phones in a different room, sit and have a nice conversation, have fun together, and then clear up together. And then what happens is if you start to do that with exercise, with movement, you start to do it with your relationships, you start to do it with your environment, that everything becomes an opportunity for building relationships, for expressing that compassion. And the physiological, biochemical, social impact of that is absolutely profound and health-giving. if you're thinking about what you can do to improve your mind, you can think about doing stuff together with other people, whether it's, you know, meditation or Tai Chi or yoga, or doesn't matter what it is. That what are the opportunities for enhancing your relationships in all the things that you're doing? And the health-giving aspect is the key. So if you know you take these little explosions of oxytocin, what happens is that that's incredibly health-giving. The biochemical impact of that, your blood pressure goes down, your heart rate goes down, your parasympathetic nervous system fires more. You know, that means that you're better able to absorb food, that your gut motility is more appropriate for the food that you're eating. There's so much richness contained within those, that whole relationship aspect of things, which is health-giving.
Yeah, I think I interviewed Sue Carter on oxytocin and also her husband, Stephen Borges, and I think they made a very compelling case for oxytocin in the myelinated vagus. Yeah, I've also seen research on the network effects of some of the things that you just talked about, right? So the people you hang out with, their diets affect your health outcome. And even so far as like, you know, your neighbor's friends, I think there's a book I can link to in the show notes. I think the author is Christakis, who's written a book on this. And then I've even seen some social psychology research recently that demonstrated it was really difficult to do randomized control trials because the two arms of the in the experiment, they talk to each other. They post stuff on Facebook, right? And so like suddenly, like if you're in the control arm, you start posting all this stuff about, you know, exercise and diet and all the rest. And the people in the other, yeah, the test arm, they see that stuff. Sorry, I've got the arms the wrong way around.
No.
The point, right? Like they're influencing each other.
This is another bugbear of mine, which is, you know, going to end up in a bit of a rant. But so we know the impact of social relationships is profound and powerful. Okay. So if you think about the conduct of a clinical trial, the so-called double-blind placebo-controlled trial, the reality is that what you have within a clinical trial is the profound impact of relationships, and that relationships are individualized. They're not something that you can control for because it's a relationships between two people. And often in a clinical trial, you get a huge input from a clinical setting, and particularly the powerful symbolic relationship of a doctor and a patient. And what that means is that your methodology of a double-blind placebo-controlled trial has got a massive question mark about it, because you cannot control for relationships. And even the basis of our medicines is flawed. I mean, it's that human contact is more powerful than most of the medicines.
Yeah, absolutely. The randomized control trial is just the wrong way to acquire knowledge for the types of interventions that you're interested in, right? I mean, you could go on like that. And it's not just relationships, it's also sleep and sunshine and all the other
absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what do you do about resistance? That's something that I feel like I've encountered a lot. You know, people, they wear their independence as a sort of badge of honor, and the last thing they want to do is owe somebody a favor. Do you find that you encounter that? I think it's like especially prevalent in the elder population, you know, where like their independence is something they spend a lot of time thinking about.
So it's interesting what you mean by independence, particularly in the elder population, because, you know, one of the things that we should think about is a routine assessment of people's sense of loneliness and isolation. And you'll find that the prevalence of it is actually quite high. And people may say they like their privacy and their independence, but they really don't like being lonely. The other thing is that I think that there are lots of ways of actually trying to bring this to the forefront of importance. And the podcast is definitely one of them, and the work that you do is one of them, and the writing of books is another, and the use of the various different kinds of media. Publicity actually has a tremendous impact on nourishing the values of what's good in life. And I think it's about making the recognition, like, we don't have to persuade anyone to be more compassionate. It's something people have to figure out for themselves. And you know, there are particularly resistant people, and you can think of certain political figures where you think, oh my God, how is that person ever going to become more compassionate? And it's like, don't worry, there's plenty of other people who can become more compassionate. And that we turn it into a social movement, that we say, right, we're going to elevate compassion. We're going to say this is fundamentally important, and we're going to talk about it, and we're going to talk about it in all the different settings. And If I think about the compassionate communities movement, which started as small practice examples in sporadic areas, and what we're seeing is that it's spreading worldwide. There are compassionate community initiatives all over the world, and there's increasing recognition of the importance of it in a whole variety of different settings. And the discussion grows and continues. And I think we just have to allow that to grow and continue as a social movement, and not as a way of beating people over the head saying, you're not compassionate, you're a terrible person, but as a way of appreciating the strengths and gifts in people and understanding that everyone has this compassionate potential. And it's okay. So when you can spark it off, and the more you can relate to people positively, the more this comes out. I don't think there's a need to persuade anyone, but just think about kindness and compassion and we'll spread it. We'll let it grow.
That's a great answer and I thank you for it, but I'm not sure you quite understood the question.
Oh, great.
So
okay.
My question is like, so what do you do about resistance in the recipient of the help? And I think I can draw on a specific example from your podcast. I'm pretty sure I heard on your podcast someone talking about an older Asian woman that was mortified at the idea of somebody coming into her home and seeing her dirty laundry. You know, like somebody wanted to come in and help her with that. Oh my goodness, no, I could never allow you to see that. I mean, I think that probably everybody listening to this podcast will recognize something like that in an older person who is fiercely independent and they don't want your help.
Yeah, I think that it's really important that we actually understand to give help to people in a way that they appreciate. And that's about finding out. It's about discovering. And it's about asking questions like, what matters most to you? And if you're offering help, you know, there has to be the choice of people going, no, actually, you know, that act of looking after my laundry and looking after my cleaning is a marker of me trying to, I find meaning and value in that and respecting it. But there'll be lots of other ways that they might appreciate help and support. And it might be sitting down, having a cup of tea. We started this thing called network enhancement about how do you enhance these naturally occurring networks. And I sit around and ask people and say, well, what's most meaningful in your life? And when you were caring for somebody who was dying, what made the biggest difference? And people talk about all kinds of different things that they were touched by. And that was, you know, people come around doing the gardening, the shopping, the cooking, the cleaning, that kind of stuff. And then somebody said, love, laughter, and friendship. And that was something I never forgot. In that moment, they expressed something really important about what we can give. And that's just our simple kindness. And that has a profound effect. And it doesn't have to be judgmental. And it's not conditional. And it doesn't say, if you don't allow me to do your laundry, then you're a bad person.
Another form of resistance that I see is I think that people don't like the idea of owing people favors. You know, and that's not just specific to the older population. I see that in people of my middle-aged generation, you know, like, so for example, you don't want me to look after your kids because you're worried that you're going to have to look after mine, that sort of thing. You know, like this very transactional way of thinking that I think is very common today.
Again, I think that's part of a shifting from this recognition of independence to interdependence. And then also, I think that, you know, giving without expectation of return is an important part of that. So it's about people feeling safe and secure and gradually finding their way. And we're talking about a shift in culture. It's why it's a social movement. And it's recognizing that, you know, if we gradually have a conversation about increasing compassion, that people can engage with it in a way that they feel comfortable, which is very, very individual. And it's never about forcing things on people. It's just about, okay, how can I take responsibility for myself? I can be a kind person. I can look after my friend's kids, and that's fine if they don't want to look after mine.
Exactly. So it's like the no expectation of return.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Apart from feeling good about looking after somebody else's kids whilst they go on a date or something, you know, like
that's
my expectation
exactly.
of return.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Have you thought about the implications for town planning? I'm sure that you have. I think that maybe that's what's missing in Bonnie Doon is there's no central gathering place, secular gathering place, should we say. So there is a church in Bonnie Doon, but there's no shop, there's no petrol station. There's really nowhere for anybody to gather. I mean, I know that in Froome, it seemed like the general practice was and the waiting room was an important place for people to gather and form community. But Have you thought about what the general implications are for town planning?
Yeah, one of the kind of key components of what happened in Frome was Frome Town Council, which is an independent council. And it was a group of people who had enough of party politics and this sense of being separate from the community. And there's now a significant democratic movement of this independence, which is not just about not belonging to a political party. It's about having respect for discussion, willing to come to an agreed conclusion, and about absolutely engaging with the local population. And the way that politics is set up in the UK makes it possible that you have what's called parish councils, which are voluntary and which are in which local people can become engaged in politics. And then there's things like flat pack democracy and asset-based community development and a variety of other initiatives which are taking place in which local people, it's not just a consultation, they actually are part of the process of change. And so there's a really big bit of this which is about politics, which is about we have to bring compassion into politics. And you can think about the way that politics is conducted now is often just focused on wealth, on the lack of it or the gaining of it or the keeping of it. So that when you think about, I think town planning is a really great example, because what is the social infrastructure? How can the planning side of things support that social infrastructure and create community? And in the UK, that the planning is done at district town council or district council level, and it's remote. There's a great word for this, and the word is subsidiarity. And what it means is when the decision is being made, are the people who are affected by that decision involved in the decision making? And the greater the gap between the people who make the decision and the people who have to live with the consequences of that decision, then the more damage that can be done. And my friend Cormac Russell talks about this in terms of buy-in and talks about, like the professional, the ultimate buy-in that you get is from an airline pilot. Because if they do something wrong, oh boy, they're the first people to be affected by it.
I see. Skin in the game, you might say.
Yeah, skin in the game is a phrase he uses.
Yeah, I mean, so Taleb has been really good on this. You know, the politics and scale, right? Like, if you don't drink my water, then you shouldn't have any power over me.
That's it. Exactly.
So tell us more about, you mentioned earlier, the summit and Compassionate Communities USA. I got USA. I want to be part of it, but I just hate that name, like USA. Like, I just don't really affiliate with USA and their politics, but I would like to become part of Compassionate Communities, and I do live in the USA. So can you tell us more about those things?
Yeah, so it kind of started off with, I spoke to a couple of colleagues and friends and say, look, I've got this book coming out, and why don't we do some bit of publicity over it? And we sat around over a virtual tea and they said, well, why don't we, if we're doing that, why don't we think about doing something bigger? And it developed into this thing, which is about, okay, well, why don't we run a conference? And then, well, if we're going to run a conference, why don't we turn it into a summit series? Because a single conference on its own is probably not that meaningful. So why don't we have something that's ongoing? And then why don't we form an organization that will gather together all of the wide variety of different initiatives that are taking place so that we can have that sense of advocacy and influencing policy about what's going on. And so it developed into this thing where we've got 2 days in June. It's a virtual conference, June the 17th and 18th, and that we are going to have a monthly lunch and learn session. And that what we hope to do is engage people, and they were willing to become members of Compassionate Communities USA. I mean, names and names, what the hell? And maybe you don't like it because you're English at heart.
Exactly. I'm kind of an odd duck though, right? I'm the outlier.
So it's about trying to make it easy for people to engage in whatever way they can. And we want it to swell as a social movement, to grow, to people to feel inspired and motivated and have a join in action together. We are better together, you know. We recognize the basic humanity in everyone, and we are inclusive, you know, that we appreciate people's strengths, then we stand a chance of maybe some good change taking place. So that's what this is all about. And the website will be up soon, and, you know, we'll be advertising it. And it's going to, we want to make it a free conference. We want as many people as possible to join in. We'd like to see thousands of people there, and we'd like to see it as a launch pad for a social movement and drawing everyone together, make it inclusive as possible, as easy as possible to join in, and for people to feel inspired and be part of this great change.
That's fantastic. You know, I've realized while you're talking, you've got a book out. What the heck, Julian? You bash on sales and marketing. They serve useful purposes, right? Like, if you're selling me something of value that's wealth creating and it's timely and relevant, then I'm more than happy to have the recommendation, you know? And so, Julian, I just found it on Amazon, The Compassion Project, for hope and human kindness from the town that beat loneliness.
Oh my goodness.
Like, I haven't read it. I feel really embarrassed now because you're so rubbish at marketing.
That's it. What can I say? I tell you, I learned a big lesson about this, that we knew in Froome that what we had was really valuable. And the way that health services are constructed in the UK is you have to go through this annual funding round. And it's agony because you have to present evidence every year that what you're doing is really good. And what that evidence means is subject to interpretation and politics. And we were really struggling with funding, and we had to lay people off in the end. It was a disaster. And as a last resort, we took to publicity. And I wrote an article in a small magazine called Resurgence. And that got picked up by George Monbiot. George Monbiot is a journalist for The Guardian. And he wrote an article about it. And then we got worldwide publicity. And as a consequence of that, we had people visiting us from all over the world, you know, different media, TV crews, radios, newspapers. And we even had the medical director of NHS England, policy advisors from Number 10 and policy advisors from the NHS, and there's been this continuing interest really as a consequence of that one article that George Monbiot wrote. And in terms of creating a story of change, that was much more effective than any scientific paper that I've written. And it was a big lesson for me about twofold. The first thing is, you know, when you talk about things that people relate to and are good, that people can say, yeah, I buy into that. And the second thing is, publicity makes an enormous difference. And whichever way that is, and writing books, being on TV, on the radio, writing articles for newspapers, they all have a role to play. And we need more of that. So it was a big lesson. I thought, you know, a really good scientific paper, that's a way to go. And I was wrong.
This is the downside of having a PhD or being a medical doctor, you see. Like, people think there's no downside, but yeah, there is a downside. You wear this invisible white lab coat all the time that makes you want to write scientific papers that nobody's going to read, right? Versus a book that gets on the New York Times bestseller list, you know, and you get a bunch of journalists show up at your doorstep.
That's right. Exactly.
So obviously I'm going to read the book next. So how do people get on? Is there an email list or something I can link to in the show notes so people can give you their email address so that when the summit is ready, that they'll get notified?
I think the website will be ready very soon. And if you search under Elevate Compassion, you'll find it there. And there'll be contact information, and there'll be you'll have the ability to enroll in the summit series. And so that we'll build the connections like that. And Compassionate Communities USA is formed, and we'll be collecting information and about start having output with that. So there is a way that everyone can join in. I think that's the essence of it.
That's fantastic. Well, Julian, this has been amazing. Thank you. I really admire your work, and I'm really hoping that I can be a part of it in the future.
Chris, you already are. You know, you're kind enough to have me on your show, not just once, but twice. I mean, goodness me, you've got some patience.
No, it's been fantastic. Honestly, it has. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I look forward to the day where we can meet up face to face.
Absolutely. Definitely. Thank you.